Bob, I did an unprecedented thing today, or was it yesterday? Anyway, I sent you a my script for my show, and normally it's about a week before you manage to hear it, because I put the show up on archive.org, and then you listen to it, and then you respond. But I found something that I wanted to communicate with you very directly, so I thought I'd send you a script, and you've had a look at it, and I'm interested in your responses.
Yes, I read the script, and it's the kind of thing that has to be read, and what I learned from it, and I also looked at the artwork, which is an ongoing thing you're making, right?
It's the particular thing we're talking about is finished. It's on Militant Aesthetics, it's under Eyeballism, and it's the first option. It's called The Artwork, and it's a series of drawings.
Okay, so realizing... or reading your script for today and scanning through the artwork, I realize that you believe that and know and act on the idea that Iris's work is way more important than anything you ever do. Her art is way better than yours. And so I will now, after 22 episodes, address my criticisms to Iris. She's the one challenging me. All right? To the degree there's a challenge here between you and me, it is more Iris that I must contend with. And
that's right. That's absolutely right, because I've seen that the whole of modern art has been about recognizing impulses which come before the concept, and therefore one of the direct roads to it would be child art. I mean, there's also the art of the insane to be considered as well. But I think child art is a good place to start, and I feel that if you can't recognise what's beautiful and uncontaminated and direct about child art, then you're never going to be able to understand modern art. Therefore, you won't ever be able to understand the 20th century. In other words, you won't be able to understand anything.
Right, and so I wouldn't want to categorise as child art, but that's the beginning point. For the audience to understand.
Yeah, I mean, this is an external description. I'd prefer to use words like pertinent or direct or worthy of consideration or fruitful for reflection, which is not something you could apply to most artworks being produced today.
Right, so the artwork is Iris. So a section of the artwork says... squeeze light white lines recalled the effect of placing an ear next to a crack in the window of a car speeding up the M1 in the early 60s. That's a description of Iris in the car. Iris will admit no governing niche, style, genre, or conceptual category. No guiding light, just darkness enveloping the bathtub. Iris is anti-Nietzschean, anti-stylistics, anti-conceptual, hostile to relegation to the stupid person's pigeonhole, throws tantrums when placed on a pedestal by the intelligent. Iris feeds pigeons with colored grains of uncooked rice and maps the territory via multicolored mandalas in guano. So that is true, that is Iris. Now, my critique of Iris, what I think Iris needs to consider in her art, bounces off what you wrote on your script for today's show. Now, I'm going to quote the part which comes from the brown bag, so maybe now is the time to mention the brown bag part.
Recently, Iris wanted to do some collages, so I opened a drawer.
See, there's Iris. Yeah. Recently, Iris wanted to use the pens or employee.
That's right. And I have a drawer full of collage materials, which I used to use myself. I used to perpetually do postcards, collage postcards, because they were small, manageable, always the same size. It's a way of doing art in a suitcase, in a way. And sure enough, I used to file away all the postcards that I made into a suitcase. So I still have a drawer full of scraps of pieces of paper that have interested me, that have been lying around, and different materials. So I pulled that all out and let her do what she wanted with them. And one of the things I pulled out and caught my eye was a brown paper bag, and it had my own writing scrawled all over it. And I discovered it was notes on Finnegan's Wake in response to things that you had said when you visited here. So I'd written down these responses, and it's a kind of manifesto of enthusiasm for Finnegan's Wake and a kind of breakthrough of my own understanding of what Finnegan's Wake is. So I decided to do a radio program on it.
Right. So what you say, what you wrote maybe a year ago, right? Maybe a year ago. You say the wake is eclectic. E-C-L-E-C-T-R-I-C. And then you say, a pun made at the start of the chapter just read from page 309 last. Adding to the virtues of eclecticism and eccentricity, the power of electricity. The network power distribution, which, were it not a tool of capitalist profit-making, could be used to free us from all feudal and local prerogatives when it comes to power. Then you say, hence, of course, the power of Bob Dobbs' McLuhanite observation that the wake is all about radio, TV, and finally the internet. But it's also about spoken sound. This is an Irish view. Irish says, but it's also about spoken sound versus script mastery. A subversive anti-authoritarian theme as old as written poetry itself. And also democratic multiplicity versus top-down discourse. Capitalized or commercial radio, TV, and websites, which something that capitalized radio, TV, and websites cannot deliver. In its anarchist confusion, postmodern politicos, from Bill Gates through to Hart and Negri, believe the internet is itself a Finnegan's Wake, but it's not. It merely lays the foundations for that revolutionary possibility. Okay, so that's a very good statement by Iris. Now, I'm glad you point out electricity, because what I would suggest, Iris, and to the degree you can understand it, Ben, is there is a groping for order in the wake and in radical modernist art. But it's a very subtle order, or it's an indifferent order, or a demonstration of how order cannot be arrived at. And that's ordering, if you understand that. See, so all these possibilities of what I mean by moving towards order. But here's the order that you can discover in the wake. You can look at the four books. It's made up of four books, which have, what, book one, 8 chapters, book two, 8 chapters, book three, 4 chapters, and book four, 1, maybe, chapter. It merges. Am I right there? Is it 8, 8, 4, and 1? Yeah, that makes 7. No, is that wrong? What do I got? No, it's 8 in the first book. Second book is 4 chapters. Third book is 4 chapters. And book 4 is something, right? Which merges back into book 1. I want to suggest to you that you can take the tetrad, McLuhan's invention, and see that Joyce was laying out a tetrad. The effects of all creativity can be mapped on the tetrad. And the tetrad has 4 parts. The first part is you look at what's been created or extended or manifested. You then notice what has been obsolesced by this new creation. And then you find older things that were obsolesced a long time ago and forgotten, and they're retrieved. And then when you use the new creation too much, overdo it, becomes a cliche, it flips into its opposite characteristics. We can see. And look at Joyce's page 614 of Finnegan's Wake. In the middle of the page, he talks about the old mill-wheeling tetradomational gazebo croticon. You know that line.
It's good. Yeah, sorry. I was finding it funny. Particularly because gazebo is seems like such a modern word to describe those tents that people put up when they want to... I don't know if you have them in Hawaii. You probably don't need them. But in England, because of the amount of rain that we have... Gazebos are these kind of tents without sides that people put up when they want to do something outside in the summer, but they're frightened of the rain, so it's kind of will shield you from the rain, and it's called a gazebo. And it's interesting that there it is, and it's because it's square, isn't it, and it's got 4 sides, but it doesn't actually have sides, so it's a 4-sided thing without sides, which is
a perfect image of Finnegan's Wake. Yeah. I mean, this is a key phrase about Joyce and what he's saying about the wake. But he has the word tetradomational. So there's the word tetrad in there in this key statement.
Yeah.
So taking McLuhan's tetrad, book one actually contains most of the book in terms of the range. It goes back to ESP and speech all the way up to television. You look at page 52, middle of the page, television kills, telephony and brothers broil. That's in book one. All the extensions that humans are going to create are in book one. Then it shows what the present environment of radio and TV coming, what they will obsolesce. And they obsolesce chapter one of book two is the children's playground. You agree with me? It's that's the basic scene there.
Mm-hmm.
And then children's rituals and nursery rhymes. Then chapter two is the classroom, right? Starting on page 260. Chapter three is the scene in the bar, but it's presented as a play, written like a play, or could even be a movie screenplay, right?
Uh-huh.
And the fourth part is the scene in the bar. And that is, all those institutions are obsolesced by the electronic magnetic city that Wyndham Lewis described, the angelization of humans. So all those arts are obsolesced. What is retrieved? Four phases of Sean, the orator, speaking in different contexts. So the tactile electric environment retrieves oral culture. You see what I'm saying? Book three, four versions of Sean, four views of Sean. You got that?
Mm-hmm.
And then the book itself, the whole situation flips into book four, which is the Armageddon apocalypse, or the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. See, so very broad view of Finnegan's Wake. Now, I present this to Iris as not to get too involved in celebrating the spoken sound versus script mastery. That is a dilemma that Iris has on her show, Out to Lunch. She wants to talk, she likes talking, and she's trying to justify it. But at the same time, present literate notions or counter the effects of literacy.
Oh.
That is what Out to Lunch is always wrestling with. And I like the way McLuhan takes the Wake and moves it beyond those fetishes, those fetish useful reminders of how to of what the Wake is pointing to.
Hmm.
And I agree with, let's just say, here's some of the things that you, that Iris sees the Wake as a...
Could I say something? I mean,
okay.
I think you and maybe McLuhan are pointing out the danger of identifications. You're pointing out the danger of intervention. Every time you try and make a difference, you need to use terms which are understood. You therefore choose your time. It's all about timing in philosophy just as much as in musical improvisation or comedy. And you choose your time to say something, to make a contribution, to push things in a way that you think they need to be pushed. Now, of course, it's possible for someone to freeze what you've said and turn that into some kind of undying principle, which would in the end be the opposite of what you really want to argue. And therefore, and I think I could demonstrate to you that in my program I had all sorts of recognitions of the opposite effect, or maybe I'm muddling that up with the program that I've just done, where I've been thinking about funk music, and particularly Zappa's work in the early, in the mid-70s, and how I thought that was funk, which is all about movement, recognizing that it's pressed on plastic, which is about something static, and producing a kind of awareness, a Varesian awareness of the structure of sound, so that funk became conscious of itself as static. And this is what Johnny Guitar Watson is, how, in fact, you can hear him like a Varese composition in the terms of an architectonic scaffolding, which you could almost draw a picture of. So that this recognition of the opposite of what something is seems to me to inform all the best interventions. Therefore, I might be saying that at the moment we've got too much mediation and too much conceptual art. The whole of Brit art, the whole of current contemporary art world is they've all sat at the feet of conceptual artists from the 70s, and they're doing a kind of hip, popular version of conceptual art. That what the intervention that I think is needed is of the unmediated, of children's art, mad people's art, the direct expression. But this would not, I'm not saying that therefore it's within the context of this argument, which is conceptual, that it's interesting to assert non-mediation. Having simply non-mediation on its own as a good would seem to me very boring.
Yes. Is there more you want to say? Because I have something to respond.
No, go,
to that.
Please. Yeah, no, respond.
See, it's very, what I see what you mean is, and it's a very good sentence, the wake is eclectic. Adding to the virtues of eclecticism and eccentricity, that's Iris, the power of electricity. It seems, Ben, that you went to Cambridge and you went to Leeds after, and you ran around telling everybody, what the heck are you guys doing here? There's a revolution going on made possible by the electronic technology. And it didn't mean just celebrating the technology. Certainly, McLuhan doesn't celebrate the technology, but the power of electricity, you've got that italicized. The network power distribution, which were not a tool of capitalist profit-making, could be used to free us from all feudal and local prerogatives when it comes to power. That's exactly McLuhan's point. It might have been Joyce.
Well, more important for me than McLuhan, I mean, that's Lenin. I mean, Lenin saw electricity as the crucial thing that could transform the society that he was revolutionizing in a social manner, was that electricity was going to be the requirement.
Okay, that's a good point. Yeah. That's Lenin, not McLuhan. What's interesting, at the time of Lenin, Pound, Eliot, Lewis, Joyce, and whoever else you want to mention that you respect, they all were inspired by electricity. And it was McLuhan who had the later advantage of time to perspective to point that out. And that is the point about electricity. What is it doing to us? Finney's Wake is about electricity, not just radio. That is something that challenges the verbal medium. It challenges the written medium and all the previous media, as I laid out from book two of Finnegan's Wake, The Obsolesced. And your very values that you wake up are what electricity does.
Well, I don't think electricity... You see, Bob, I have a problem with the phraseology of McLuhan, because I think it turns into a techno-determinism or an explanation via... and you're talking about tetrads, these...
It's a
formula, and therefore you turn the box and a new side is shown, and you're continually fitting everything into that, and to me it's almost like someone hypnotized by various baubles on a Christmas tree, their tetrads bobbing away, that they can't see the reality that those concepts should be helping you to grasp. And I don't think in itself electricity does anything at all. That electricity is used by people, and it's only when it's used by people that it means anything at all. Like time, like all these things that we talk about, only if they are used in anger, when that expression meaning used for a purpose, does any of it matter? And simply sort of like we move from one age to another, I see a kind of a schematic view of history that I find repellent.
Well, I know that, and I'm not trying to create a schematic, but I'm saying this is a map to getting away from being trapped by the electricity.
Well, absolutely. You see, and that interests me about your particular polemic. I don't know whether it's because I go on about Finnegan's Wake a lot that you respond and therefore are going on about Finnegan's Wake. I don't know in the rest of your arguments and discussions with people whether how much Finnegan's Wake comes up. And this is the question I wanted to ask you, which is that to raise up Finnegan's Wake when you're discussing TV and radio and the internet, for most media commentators and discussions, it would be completely grotesque. to suddenly bring up this great thick old book of kind of gibberish, you know, radical modernism, and say it had any relevance to the discussion at all. It'd been an extremely weird move. Can you imagine Wired magazine having articles about Finnegan's Wake? Now, you can tell me they do, but it just doesn't. Because
no, you know who did it? The Australian response to Wired, the magazine 21C. Did you ever see that?
Right.
With Daryl Tofts.
Yeah.
They celebrated Don Thiel's work in
but,
Finnegan's Wake.
But I'm interested in why it would feel grotesque, and it's because Finnegan's Wake produces a kind of it slows everything down. It asks people to pay attention to something as tiny as a typographical error, or what looks like an error, in the midst of a word. It therefore has the very opposite effect of the so-called accessibility of electronic media, that when you simply turn on Freeview television and switch from channel to channel, that it induces a state in which you feel there are people just giving you this information and this entertainment, and that's got no problems involved in it at all. There's absolutely nothing for your own mind to bite on. And Finnegan's Wake,
River Run, River Run.
And so Finnegan's Wake, in a way, is the complete opposite of that. It's shocking.
Yes.
Because it asks you to actually seize on something that you might use, that it gives you, if you're thinking, it gives you moments which force you to reflect on your own ideas and force you to produce your own ideas. It's a kind of spur. It's a shock. It's a bucket of cold water thrown on you. It does something so different from modern media in the normal way it's perceived, that to introduce it seems to me to be revolutionary. I mean, it is something quite amazing. You know, if you're on a talk show talking about computers and you produce the relevance of Finnegan's Wake or recite some of it. And it's that shock that I'm interested in. And I think it could equally well be supplied by a four-year-old talking, being taken seriously in a discussion at a high level in various circumstances. And these things all require placement, and I'm not saying therefore that a radio channel devoted to children would in itself be critical or revolutionary. Indeed, somebody said to me, I think I heard Iris on Resonance, and I said, well, what did you hear? And they said, it was a whole hour of children talking. I said, no, it won't be me. I have her on for 4 minutes and then contrast it with something else.
It's like when you have your next audition to get on Iraqi or Al Jazeera TV and they present the role they want you to play. Your answer would be to turn on a tape recorder and let them listen to Iris for 45 seconds. See, it's that kind of move, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, these things have relevance. But you want it to be, when you want people to pay attention in that way, it seems to me an awful lot of cultural production is defused by turning it into an entire world. For example, the recording of animals seems to me fascinating and disturbing, because you can show how and one of my polemics was that Anthony Braxton was good when he could play like a pig, and I played grunting pigs, and I played Braxton playing contra bass clarinet, and I actually meant it. I mean, people thought that I was doing some kind of disrespect to Braxton, but I think he was accessing something more primal than being a human being, something physical, and that's very special and fantastic.
Okay, you stop. Yeah, I'm going to say something. Now, I'm getting a bit of echo, but it's a little irritating, but I'm okay. You're exactly right about my use of Finney's Wake. I've always used that on every other radio show for 25 years. If I want to throw a monkey in the wrench in the works, I do that. And that's what Joyce did with Finnegan's Wake. But I don't... That is a tactic.
Well, I'm not sure I want to throw a monkey in the wrench, actually. I want to articulate what my dissatisfaction with the mode of communication that leads towards screens and desks. You see, I mean, you talk about electricity and computing and the modern world as if they're all the same thing, but I mean, electricity has been channeled down various routes. There are all kinds of things that could be done with electricity which aren't being done. And everything has ended up with the bureaucratic mechanism of the computer, which is a reproduction of the old bourgeois desk. You're sitting on your own, organising your materials on a desktop. And so I see that the social constraints are limiting what technology can deliver, rather than always seeing technology as a thing which the reactionaries haven't noticed. That's the difference between our critiques.
Well, that's exactly my critique. See, this is what's odd, is that McLuhan was saying, look, you guys are going to go nuts because of this electricity. You can't handle it. You better turn it off for 6 months and get your bureaucracies in order, because we're going to get more and more bureaucracy as you freeze like a reaction formation to the electric effect. The river run. Remember, the first word of Phoenix Wake is river run. That's the flow that the wake wants to interrupt. Now, when I talked to Joyce, he told me that he was outraged at the electric environment. He thought the only real art was writing and reading, and that's what he was trying to create, a book that could be read through the electric holocaust.
But I think he's trying to write a book that can be read from any point of view at any time and will have relevance. He was trying to produce
a book with staying power.
Yeah, he was trying to produce a book that could become an object for the collision of languages, which he saw happening in capital centres that he was in and could see was going to increase as society evolved, that this clash of languages and clash of people, not necessarily a clash but a living together and a communication between peoples, was going to escalate. And therefore he saw the experience of misunderstanding and of pleasure in the sound of voices and pleasure in misunderstandings and being able to improvise meanings from those misunderstandings as an essential part of what meaning is. And this put him right out of the circle of the names that you mentioned as all sort of going along with Joyce, Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot and Wyndham Lewis, excuse me, who all wanted to insist on meaning as controlled from above. I mean, that political difference, I think, is really important in Joyce, and lumping him together with all the rest of them as some kind of modernist movement seems to me what the conventional history has done, but which does Joyce a big disservice.
Yeah, that's why my chart is based on Finnegan's Wake, and the Dobbs quadrant is symbolized by Joyce, but the other quadrants, as I mapped on you, is a response to technology in a paranoid way, that's Ezra Pound, a response to the schizophrenia effect of electricity, leads to Wyndham Lewis, a response to the hysterical or mystical view of electricity is T.S. Eliot, and the response to, I call it the postmodern ethos, was W.B. Yeats, and that's panic. So those four ways of response I see in you and most of our citizens today, but Joyce offered a way of looking at it and subsuming those four responses. So I call Joyce ecstatic. He's the response of ecstasy. But it's not a innocent primitive ecstasy. It's a super civilized X-raying ecstasy. It might even be mistaken as a reactionary old fogey who wanted us to stay in the book world.
Yeah.
He didn't. And that includes all, you celebrate ecstasy and all the values you celebrate. It's interesting, I have in the Dobbs Quadrant, I quote the zine, Ben is dead, and I did that in 95. I don't know if I was thinking about you, but I was aware of your book, but the on Zappa. But the values you express that you're for, I would conclude in under the sign of ecstasy. And I have Joyce doing that. But the problem is that we're in an environment now where everybody's in ecstasy with their chip bodies and their TV bodies. And only Finnegan's Wake offers a check to that.
Okay, Bob. I'm getting a very bad echo on your voice now, so I think we need to stop this and start it again. Not for listeners, okay, but for us. Hang on.
Okay, so we had a little interruption there now. What I find about interesting about your writing is that the supposed values you wake up that you think you're supporting all can be included in Finnegan's Wake and are best represented by Finnegan's Wake. But we know that just relying on a book for this new world we're in is silly. And that's why I bring up the Wake in talk show formats and conversation. But the Wake is not my Bible. My Bible is the present and what's happening and how to respond to it, knowing that the loose response, the one that isn't subject to concepts or to categories or to favoring one medium over another, is the, quote, correct response. And it is actually how everybody's supposed to live anyways. See, it's very interesting. Could be a meaning of Finnegan's Wake. We have awakened, but people don't know how to express it to themselves or how to mediate it. We actually live unmediated. Now, there's an interesting point. We live unmediated today, which is what Baudrillard and them tried to point out, the postmodern. They celebrate it. I'm not saying we should celebrate it, but we are unmediated. That means, I use the term paramedia. There's no division between anything. And the only thing that everybody agrees that kind of isolates everybody is make some money. That's the only thing that props up the individual separateness. It actually, making money is revolutionary as a psychological response to the unmediated. That's the contradictions. I'm not for that. I'm saying that's what's happening.
I suppose I'm in favor of an embracing of the unmediated, that money separates us, but that we could supersede money and therefore really enjoy the unmediation that we're having to fend off all the time. I mean, the only people that I know who live in unmediated ways and I think are the true artists are, well, in fact, I only know one, that's Gamma. I know someone who lives in a way which allows every chance symbol to mean whatever can be, whatever falls off it, that he's unrepressed in the sense that he allows his unconscious to speak. And I was very impressed when he was reading my attempts to write beyond Finnegan's Wake into assaults on conceptual reason in the English language. He's reading one out and the phone rings, he answers it and goes straight on reading my text, which showed a relationship to authority and money and friends which is unbelievably secure, in the sense that there was, everybody has to put up with his nonsense in the particular business that he pursues. He's not a huge boss frightening people, but he's found a way of surviving in which he's not frightened of anybody. Most people would stop what they were doing if they were reciting some poetry by a friend and the phone went, because they'd be worried that they might lose a job by sounding ridiculous on the phone to somebody. And that seems to me the position we should all reach, where we don't have a separation and a system of pretenses in order to behave certain ways because we're worried about our jobs and our behaviour in the social realm. I'm looking to solve an alienation which has been recognised as you can look back in terms of religious terms of about the Protestant ethic and the work ethic and the whole appearance for others, which became what public life is. And I'm arguing that something did get squashed in that, which is your id, or your more bodily responses to things. And that if we could achieve an expression for the id which would not be antisocial, because the reason it's so trammelled is that people are frightened that if they let it out, it'll be antisocial and society will crumble. But I think Gamma demonstrates that true sociality depends upon letting this thing out.
So you think Gamma is the best simulation of Iris?
Yeah, I think he's somebody who's in touch with the childish pleasures, who hasn't introduced concepts to, but he's doing it at a higher level because he knows what he's fighting, whereas Iris is 4 years old and trying to hang on to all these things, and very rapidly she's at school, she's having to learn this and that, and there's a whole system of development that has to happen. That I'm looking for a way of appreciating what Iris contributes, but I'm not saying that I want to arrest development at the 4-year-old level.
Yeah, I see Gama. You're talking about how he lives with the TV body, the telephone, what were the old analog media, and his chemical body. But Gamma, as I know, and you may not, is a maniac on the chip body. He's doing a lot of work in his chip, expending his id in the chip landscape.
Yeah, this is all his
every
Facebook.
Every other day I have a new friend thanks to Gamma.
Yeah,
I mean, on Facebook. I don't even know who these people are. But the thing is, I don't see Gamma as a part of our agenda. Let me see. Okay, so I can accept Gamma, what he's doing and the values you see in that and what he represents. But there is something he's not doing, which is what I want this program to get to. Uh-huh. I want to wake Gamma up on some level.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he's fully awake yet. And even being awake is not the right term. There are things Gamma doesn't know. When I stayed there and interact with him, I found him too devoted to Robert Anton Wilson and Rudy Rucker and those subgenius guys.
Gamma's
listening to this. I want Gamma to hear this.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to make of me. And he kept trying to fit me back in. I think I out-gammed Gamma when I stayed there. Mm. And Gamma knows it.
And I think you can do it in a way I can't, because all those sort of criticisms which I would air, Gamma would simply put down to a certain kind of traditional left intellectualism, which doesn't put pleasure forward as the primary reason for thinking, that all those thinkers represent for Gamma a kind of pleasure. And I find it hard to explain to him that I don't find them pleasurable, because they are half-cocked, and that for true pleasure I need Hegel and Marx, that is a true pleasure of thinking. But I find it hard.
No, let me hold that. That's really good. That's exactly the issue. I was better able to do what you would like to communicate to him, because I came out of that world. He thought I was J.R. Bob Dobbs, which is his hero.
Yeah.
And then I show up there, and I'm not like the J.R. Bob Dobbs that he preferred or thought he liked. And that's what you can't do. Because you didn't do it, and I did it, and that's what you mean.
Yeah.
I was able to enter his hologram more effectively.
But you must recognize, Bob, how skewed thinking is in Britain by our class system, where thinking is so associated with an oppressive ruling class approach that bad thinking is preferred as some kind of revolutionary snigger versus the establishment. And there's a huge amount of the counterculture is intellectually hamstrung by this problem, where they find a kind of ridiculously poor thinker like Robert Anton Wilson kind of subversive, because he's ours and he isn't like those toffs over there who think properly. And
that's right. Would you put Alan Moore, is that his name? He's a big hero in that world.
Yeah, certainly. And then, of course, there's the respect that people have for Alan Moore, because he also writes popular things and is commercially successful. And so you have a writer like Ian Sinclair, who makes himself stupid because he forgets his own avant-garde position, which he had originally, and becomes so enamoured of J.G. Ballard and Alan Moore and Geoffrey Archer, down to Geoffrey Archer, because of their commercial success, that this alchemy of commercial success becomes the alchemy of the counterculture, that the counterculture is fascinated with the mysticism. Well, the really big mysticism, of course, is making money. That's the most impressive magic of all. So you rapidly find that these people who counteract the rationality of Marxism and the left by their interest in magic very rapidly become people who are in awe of money making and decide that actually Hollywood is the biggest mystical pyramid there is, and they want to rise to the summit of that.
Now, this is the reason why we talk. That's exactly my view. Yes, the Gammas and that are the sniggerers. They're sniggering, and they're left impotent. You are keeping demanding potency in some way. I don't know if you're ever going to get it, but you want a kind of potency, and that's why you remain more gamma than gamma. You're more isolated than gamma.
Yeah.
Because you don't even get, you're more alienated than him.
And I'm prepared to take quite a lot of shtick for being, I mean, the thing that always gets thrown at me in the English class system is that to talk like this, I must be a Cambridge intellectual and a toff and not really part of the merry band of anarcho kind of right-thinking sort of groovy
like
people.
Like Danny. What was Danny's last name? Houston?
Danny Houston, friend? Yeah.
Danny was a victim of that. He couldn't take it as far as you.
Danny was, but he had such a strong idea of people's behaviour and of what joy could be, that kind of radical sociality he had put him far in advance of the anti-intellectuals. He was very anti-intellectual himself. But he was always very critical of what people are really doing to each other. And I remember him pointing at an advertisement for Smirnoff vodka, and it had the label of the Smirnoff plastered on people's heads. And he was saying, do you see they're actually selling it? It's great to blind yourself with drink. And he could see directly what the advertisement was doing, because he minded about people's behaviour and what's being done to them. And that kind of care can actually leap you ahead of all these sort of poses that people have in a class fractured society where people take one position or another and despise the other half as intellectual or non-intellectual or what have you. It can actually, that a sympathy with people and a critical idea of society can actually make you outsmart the intellectuals. I mean, I think Frank Zappa was an example of that as well.
Yes. So that's what I said earlier. You went to Cambridge, but you didn't get turned on to Zappa until a year or two in Cambridge?
No, I'd been exposed to We're Owning It for the Money by my brother, who'd been at Durham University studying Arabic, and his household had We're Owning It for the Money. And it was actually in Italy where students from Mexico played me the Grand Wazoo and Apostrophe, and I was very impressed with those records.
Okay, but your revelation you got from Danny Houston, is when your third year at Cambridge, 76, 77?
No, it was my first year at Cambridge I met him. I had a letter published in an emulation of Rolling Stone in Britain called Street Life, which tried to be a big counterculture newspaper about rock music and politics. They had interviews with ex-CIA agents, and it was a very bold step in publishing. And I had a letter published in there, and he got in touch with me. And I remember showing this letter to my friend, and I was absolutely amazed that you should publish a letter in a magazine and someone, not the editor, but someone reading, should get in touch with you. And it was the way that Danny networked using what communication systems were available to him that impressed me. And it also inoculated me against the fetishism of media, which sort of flooded over us during the cyber boosting years of the 80s, because he had already worked out that with the post and with tape recorders you could listen to gigs you hadn't been at like 2 days after they'd happened, if you had someone you knew well enough and were swapping tapes with. So he showed that the technology already existed for downloading files. It just required daring to take a tape recorder into a club, recording an interesting gig, copying the tape and putting it in the post. And so the whole idea of downloading didn't seem that exciting to me, because it just seemed like a slightly easier way of doing something that I've been doing for years, inspired by Danny.
Right, and
it's the daring to do the social act. You see, it's daring to take the tape recorder to the gig, the risk of being caught, that kind of skimming the area of the law, which seems to me to be the thing that broke you through to new areas, rather than simply consuming the latest high-tech gizmo.
Right, and the point I made half an hour ago or so was that you went to Cambridge, but once you'd been enlightened by Danny, or he made clear what you really thought and were already thinking to be, you therefore were always an outsider at Cambridge, telling them, the heck with this stuff, what about Frank Zappa?
Well, Danny was helping me articulate something which I already felt, which was that the music was so challenging it required psychoanalysis rather than knowledge or expertise on music itself. That what was interesting about music was playing things and then trying to articulate how it made you feel And that was what you did when you sat around having a drink and listening to records in your room. And finding that people around me were incredibly insensitive to how music sounded. They didn't seem to want to articulate. And that was putting together that the polemic that's there in Captain Beefheart and Frank Zappa all the time, that higher education actually stunts your ability to articulate what your emotions are. So all this could really exist independent of all the structures of talking about is it records or books, or, you know, the McLuhanite kind of framework, and could be fitted into a left Freudian framework of talking about what inhibits and how education, because of its Christian provenance, is actually aimed at repressing the sexual instincts. And so it could be something to do with instincts and education that really interests me, that I think is the hinge point. Though obviously recognizing that because lower class people have managed to express themselves via recording in a way that they couldn't do in terms of text, because their particular accents could actually be documented in a way that's difficult when you're writing things down, although Rabbi Burns had a really good go at one point, you know, that there is a technological aspect to it, but it's this, it's the to do with the psyche and sexuality that I think, you know, one should put at the beginning of understanding what this battle is about.
Yeah, I suggest that's the values of McLuhan, but he said, don't forget how you could get fooled by whatever little revolution you get going. That's the tetrad. Push it, you extend something, create something, it will flip into its opposite effects.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you start with the sexual revolution and you end up with Hugh Hefner and Playboy. I mean,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And so McLuhan wrote, he outraged his colleagues at the University of Toronto and actually wrote for Playboy. But what he wrote, one of his best articles, was done in the style of Finnegan's Wake almost, one step below, in the middle of, he interventioned, you know, to intervene into Playboy and criticize, he was to explain how why sex was dead. Mm. And he'd give technical reasons. So he put on the science of his day. But it was all for the agenda of id release.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, I'm an Enlightenment thinker, so I think id can be released because the ego finds a restructures itself, not because you kind of blow the head off the ego and just allow the untrammeled id to sort of crawl all over the place.
You see, there you are the contrarian. Whatever I say, if I start sounding what you're saying, you will qualify yourself in relationship to that.
This is how we think. The thing that's interesting with you, Bob, is that we're thinking together. I mean, normally, when one's writing well, that's how one writes. One says things and then looks at what it's left out or what's wrong with it, and then you go further, and that's your next sentence. That's what proper writing is. But we seem to have found a way in which we can voice each other's, you know, write the second sentence for each other.
Yeah, we take turns being the other guy and finishing the prose.
Yeah. And when our conversations don't go well, and if sometimes, you know, I think we have highs and lows, when they're low, I feel I've been cast as this particular person by you, and I haven't managed to slip round and show that actually you're me. And if I don't manage to achieve that, I don't leave these conversations with a smile.
That's right. And now Gamma's going to think that I put the donkey tail on him, you know. That's the effect of speech, and you got to be aware that that someone will feel that, and I'm not meaning it, so I accept your objection, and then I find out the objection is what I meant to say.
Well, Gamma might be quite pleased with the donkey tail attached to his bottom at the moment, because I tend to feel such enthusiasm, and I kind of need Gamma as therapy. That
he's your Danny Houston, right?
He's my second Danny Houston, and he was included in a film about people in Kentish Town, the area where he lives, because he's quite a famous street drinker in that area. And there was 10 minutes of him being interviewed, and he kissed his poodle and so on, to everyone's disgust and relish. And I made a badge, two badges, a picture of a photograph of Gamma, and in one hand he was holding a cigar, and I made that a second badge that you could pin next to it. And so I had this big Gamma badge, and he saw that, and he just made me take it off. He thought it was really bad karma, and he didn't like me turning him into a cult. So maybe the best thing to stop someone turning into a cult is to pin a donkey tail on them. Did you know that Iris won the pin the tail on the donkey competition at her school in her second week?
Just now? Just last week?
Yeah. She came home and said, I won
ESP.
The...
I decided to start talking about Iris this week, and she won.
She won the pin the tail on the donkey. I felt a little bit disturbed, because I remember when I was young and I played that game at parties, I was never quite sure who was the idiot. You know, if you're pinning a tail on a donkey, you know, if you win, are you in fact the donkey, you know, and feeling slightly ill at ease about it. But I was pleased she won it, because she isn't the best at drawing, or there are all sorts of things which she's not particularly fast at. But with spatial awareness and where things are, I do find her very good. We often come out of a shop and I start walking in the wrong direction, and she goes, no daddy, it's this way. So getting the tail on the donkey seemed, you know, quite appropriate. I could see her doing that.
But talking about Gamma is so representative of what we're talking about here, we've been doing for 23 weeks, is we're talking about someone in London, and we're saying he represents the energies we get from Lewis, Joyce, Zappa, McLuhan, or whatever, right? Or Marx or Lenin.
We're all battlefields for this... For the conflict and the coming together of these ideas, that to think is to open your head to all these struggles happening inside you. That the idea that we get committed to one person and then we go out and battle other people is kind of anti-thinking. Thinking's not like that. Thinking is something we're all sharing, and that we're all doing. We're all having this battle in our heads. And the particular case of Gamma, I think, comes out of the counterculture, and he has its possibilities and also its defects. But his enthusiasm for my writing is leading him in a different direction. Although I often get frustrated that I can't push it, you know, in ways that, say, you were able to.
You mean in relation to Gamma?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the brown paper bag screed, and here's how it ends. Gamma is certainly a critic of received pronunciation English, but Gamma's physical denseness, a book a person you have to mouth and dance and live to understand, is a polemic. Gamma is a polemic versus the perceived accessibility of the new media and the way advertising news and opinions squash the individual experience of the viewer in favor of the standardized generality of the product.
Yeah,
Gamma,
because Gamma takes it all. And
Gamma's, let me say this: yeah. Gamma's "Come All Ye" is pitted against the "Come All Ye" of Spectacular Address. Hmm. It is not its herald or John the Baptist. I agree with that.
Yeah, he's not announcing that we should all consume, but he's showing how to deal with items of consumption, which is that you take them into your own and you cut them in half and stick them together and rearrange them and do what you will with them and allow them to become part of your articulation in the way that we should use language. It's not a matter of repeating mantras from elsewhere. It's of actually using language is to take it, break it into bits and build it out yourself. And I think that's what Gamma does with the counterculture he's been given.
That's right. When Gamma hears this, I haven't had an email from him lately, but I will get an email with some incomprehensible bunch of syllables will be his response to the show.
Mm. Yeah, and normally pondering those gives me more food for thought than some smart ass who can include what we're saying in a few drab common or garden concepts.
Right, but I still say that response I'll get from Gamma is inadequate to the dimensions we're living in. I still say that nobody's getting me yet. Remember James Joyce at the end of Finney's Wake? Does nobody understand me? Will anybody understand me? You remember that in the last couple pages?
But maybe you know, being understood is a kind of death. You know, that not being understood is the energy of dialogue and life. You know, that
if you had said something else, I would have said that to you. See, we're Tweedledee Tweedledum here.
Yeah.
But we're trying to figure out what do they want from us? How can we help?
Well,
we're here to help. What do you want us to do?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And the reason I'm speaking like that is we're coming to the end of this edition of the Bob and Ben Show. Thanks for talking to me, Bob.
Call Iris and Bob now.
Okay. The Iris and Bob Show. That's it for this week. Please tune in again next week.